From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Freddie Wesley Brookins Jr., and it feels great to be out right now.
Texas frees 12 residents of Tulia after they served years in prison based on the unsubstantiated testimony of a narcotics agent who himself has now been indicted. And former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader gives his first major address on the Israeli-Palestine conflict.
It's a severe criticism of our policy that our government has never allied itself with the very, very sizable peace movement inside Israel.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 12 people arrested in the controversial drug sting in Tulia, Texas in 1999 were set free yesterday. The hearing took only 22 minutes and included brief statements from four of the 15 defense attorneys present, most of which were an attack on Tom Coleman, the undercover agent on whose word 38 convictions were obtained. At a hearing related to the case in April, Coleman was charged with lying under oath about his background. Coleman arrested 43 people in 1999 on charges of selling small amounts of cocaine. He had no corroborating evidence and the biggest drug sting in local history. 10% of the African-American community was arrested. In some cases, hometown juries later meted out sentences ranging from 12 years to more than 300. Yesterday, Democracy Now! Spoke with attorney Margaret Ratner of the William Moses Kuntzler Fund for Racial Justice. She was in Tulia as the men and women were being released.
First, congratulations.
Thank you. Okay, well, right now we're at the Swisher County Memorial, where there was a great barbecue to celebrate the release of 12 of the Tulia defendants, who were miraculously released from the courtroom this morning after the judge ruled that they could have bond. And in this case, they were released on their own recognizance after signing a bond. The judge ruled that since he felt that the Court of Appeals would rule in their favor, that he would release them on bond. And once the Court of Appeals did rule in their favor, he would dismiss he would withdraw the bond and they would be totally free.
So what was the scene like? The defendants were brought in from prison?
They were brought in from prison in chains, which was, you know, a kind of terrible thing to see because it had already been ruled that the grounds upon which they had been convicted of drug charges were insufficient because of the fact that the only witness against them was an informant, an undercover agent, who was subsequently accused of perjury and had been caught in a number of lies. So that under those circumstances, if they were ordered to have a new trial, there would be no evidence against them and everything would be dismissed. Now, because of the complicated procedural questions involved, they were released on bond pending the Court of Appeals ruling accepting the judgment of the lower court saying that they should be retried. But the retrial is not a reality because there is no witness against them. They were brought into the courthouse in chains. They were allowed to put on street clothing. They sat in the jury box. The courtroom was entirely full. Their family members filled the courtroom and spectators and the press was enormous for Tulia, Texas. And then the judge ruled that he would release them on their own recognizance after a habeas corpus motion was brought by the lawyers.
And so the chains were taken off them?
Yes. By the time they were in the jury box, there were no chains on them. They were chained as they were brought into the courthouse. But the chains were taken off before they really reached the courtroom.
How many people, if there are still in jail in this drug sting? And what has happened to Tom Coleman, the man who arrested them all?
Tom Coleman is under indictment for perjury at this point. He's not been around. He's not been seen lately on the streets. And that's going to be a very interesting situation. And what was your other question?
Just asking what happened to Tom Coleman and if anyone else is in jail.
Yes, there are still two people, I believe, in jail, one of whom has a hold on another charge, and that it charges from a different county, and it was a parole violation that was caused by this charge. But in order to be released, he has to first be bonded out on this charge and then go to the other county in Texas and be released there. That's one defendant. The other defendant who is still in jail has an appeal pending and decided to go ahead with the appeal rather than be released at this time.
Well, thanks very much, and again, congratulations. Attorney Margaret Ratner, who is right now in Tulia, Texas. Freddie Wesley Brookings Jr. is one of the men who were released yesterday. Feel today?
I feel great.
Can you describe what happened in the courtroom today?
Really, he just told us that we'll be out on bond and, you know, so be careful. That's basically what all he said, but I mean, it was a blessing. That's what happened. A blessing happened in the courtroom today.
How much time did you spend in jail?
I spent 3.5 years. Okay.
How do you think this happened?
Really, I'm still wondering the same thing.
How old are you?
26.
What are your plans now?
Now it's find me a job, take care of my family, and wait to go to school this fall.
What do you think should happen to Tom Coleman?
What do I think should happen?
Yes.
I really think that he should go through the same thing that we went through.
Freddie Wesley Brookings Jr., one of the 12 men and women who were released by a Texas judge yesterday in Tulia. A recently retired top White House counterterrorism advisor is warning that the Bush administration is failing to preserve the country's safety, in part because the war in Iraq robbed domestic security programs of staff, brain power, and money. In addition, the former official, Rand Beers, says the Iraq war could lead to a new generation of al-Qaeda recruits. Since Beers resigned, he's graduated from criticizing his former boss, President Bush, to attempting to oust him from power. In an extensive interview with the Washington Post, Beers revealed he's now volunteering for Senator John Kerry's campaign as the candidate's national security advisor. The New York Times has found conditions at the U.S. military detention camp at Guantanamo Bay are so bad many captives have tried to kill themselves over the past year. The detainees are held in wire mesh cells measuring 6.5 feet by 8 feet. Detainees are given 2 blankets and a prayer mat. They sleep and eat on the ground. They pray on the ground. And the prisoners until recently were taken out of their cells only once a week in order to take a 1-minute-long shower. After complaints, the military extended the time out of the cell to 10 minutes per week. A top British official in Iraq is now predicting U.S. and British troops will have to stay in place for up to 4 years due to the mass opposition to the U.S. presence and the slow reconstruction process. Major General Freddie Vigors compared the situation to Bosnia, where British troops have remained for 11 years. Senior members of two Palestinian groups, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, said yesterday they'll refuse to consider a ceasefire until the Israeli government takes steps to stop targeted killings and dismantle Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was assailed by pro-peace legislators in the Knesset who accused him of deceiving the U.S. government and the Israeli people by claiming to support the roadmap even as he ordered assassinations of Palestinians. The 9 nations of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, yesterday called on the Burmese military to free pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. President Bush has appointed Ed Gillespie, a leading corporate lobbyist, to head the Republican National Committee. 3 years ago, Gillespie founded Quinn Gillespie and Associates, which has grown into one of Washington's most lucrative lobbying agencies. Clients of Quinn Gillespie include Enron, Tyson Foods, DirecTV, Microsoft, SBC Communications, Verizon, and Viacom. Public Citizen's Joan Claybrook decried the selection, saying, quote, "This is just one more step in the merger of the Republican Party and corporate America." Ed Gillespie is a richly rewarded lobbyists who greased the wheels in Congress and the White House for Enron, one of the most crooked companies in U.S. history, and now he's at the head of the GOP. That should tell citizens where President Bush's interests lie. Those the words of Joan Claybrook. Gillespie replaces Mark Racicot, who will become President Bush's campaign manager. And CBS News and its parent company Viacom is coming under criticism for its tactics in securing an exclusive interview with rescued POW Jessica Lynch. The Times reports the media conglomerate sent Lynch a letter that combined offers from CBS News, CBS Entertainment, MTV Networks, and Simon & Schuster Publishers. All four companies are owned by Viacom. The letter said the CBS movie decision would be interested in doing a film that specializes in inspirational stories of coverage. Simon & Schuster would consider a book about Jessica's journey from Palestine, West Virginia to Iraq, and MTV was offering to host a special concert in Palestine, West Virginia, featuring a top star such as Ja Rule. And CBS News, of course, would get the exclusive interview. ABC and NBC News also made offers, but said their proposals mentioned only news division opportunities. And that's some of the news at this hour. As we turn to Ralph Nader, talks to persuade Palestinian militants to agree to a six-month ceasefire ended inconclusively last night. As the talks appeared to reach a stalemate, Ariel Sharon, the Israeli prime minister, said in a speech to the Knesset, that Israel's parliament, that a ceasefire would not be enough and demanded a comprehensive ongoing war by the new Palestinian government against the militants. Not all politicians hold the same views as U.S. President George Bush, who said the world must, quote, deal harshly with Hamas, which he blames for the near collapse of the so-called roadmap to peace, while Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee Richard Lugar said Sunday U.S. troops may have to be sent into Israel to stop Hamas. Many politicians have been speaking out on the issue. Among the people who spoke this weekend was Ralph Nader. He delivered an address to the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee convention in Washington, D.C. this last weekend. He talked about civil liberties, the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, and in this speech gave the most comprehensive address he has to date on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. This is Ralph Nader.
The American Bar Association last year did manage to speak out against the Justice Department snooping on conversations between clients and their attorneys. But they stopped short of going into the other areas, the other canyons of the Patriots Act. Now, this is very troubling, and it brings to mind the words of that German theologian. And I have tried myself to get some bar groups of general application, not the civil rights bar groups, the state bar associations and national, to speak out, and they just don't think things are bad enough. And I told them, well, what is your breaking point? How bad should it be? Don't you know that it's more difficult to speak up the more you delay? We shouldn't be too cocky about the inherent defenses for our liberties and our rights that we assume too quickly lie in the interstices of our democratic fabric. We're entitled to be very, very worried and very concerned. Not only on behalf of the hundreds who were incarcerated without charges, without their names being released, without access to lawyers, but for all of their relatives and all other Americans who wished and wanted to speak out, but they kept it within themselves for fear of being labeled, of being placed under surveillance. How many of you, since September 11th, have wanted to speak your mind on numerous occasions, but thought better of it? A few days ago, the Inspector General for the Justice Department came out with a report rapping the knuckles of the Attorney General and his associates for not adequately distinguishing between innocent people with Arab or Islamic names, surnames, and people who evidence would show deserved scrutiny. When the Inspector General inside the Justice Department goes that far, and I commend that report to you, it's on their website, you can imagine how far he would have liked to go, because he is under the supervision of the Attorney General, and he does like his job. But this is the first glimmer of public concern within the government that is shared by the concern of many attorneys in the Civil Rights Division and other areas of the Justice Department, and by many people in the State Department, and by many people who have recently worked for the government. But they haven't yet organized themselves to take a stand. We have noted, of course, in our own experience, what kind of discrimination we have been encountering. The first and second generation of immigrants from Lebanon and Syria suffered a lot of the discrimination. But they were too, what is the word? They were too either cautious to speak out, or they tried to shrug it off, or they tried to say, well, compared to the discrimination we're getting in this country, it's nothing compared to the Ottoman Empire. But it was there in all its forms, social, occupational, professional, political, economic. But the third and fourth generations helped organize this group because they just didn't want to take it anymore. They'd seen the work of Professor Shaheen and the way their ethnic groups were depicted in Hollywood films, and they personally felt the sting. And it was a sting that often came with a reward if you didn't organize against it. You got a job. You sold something to a buyer or a wholesaler. But I think it's time now to expand the resistance to this because of the Patriot Act and all that I have mentioned that's been going on in terms of mislaw enforcement. Otherwise, what will happen is that the penumbra of discrimination will expand rapidly in proportion to the hardcore and serious violation of people's rights and the incarceration of innocent people. I hope that you'll consider, when you go back to your homes, doing what citizens are now building in places like Illinois and Connecticut, small groups of councils focusing on the Patriot Act, focusing on stopping Patriot Act 2, focusing on educating people that this threat applies to all of them. And in so doing, thousands of these little informal groups are holding teach-ins, meetings, and living rooms. And I hope that you will join some of your friends who are already doing this, as well as others. Turning now to the Iraq-Afghanistan situation. I said at the time that it's going to be a lot easier to get into Afghanistan than to get out of it, and that it's a lot easier to get into Iraq than to get out of it. And all that, of course, is known to anybody who knows anything about that region, because we are very good as a military force in destroying opposition. We have trouble in the aftermath. The unconstitutional war that was declared, not declared, and the illegal war against Iraq under international law are not just technicalities. Our founding fathers made it very clear, after long debate, they did not want the declaration of war to be put in the hands of one person in the White House, in the presidency. They wanted it in Congress, Article 1, Section 8. It was treated, except for people like Senator Byrd, was treated like it was a technicality. Replace it with a war resolution. A country that is not under attack cannot start another attack against another country under imminent threat under international law. The Bush administration thumbed their nose at an ongoing process of the United Nations, which was trying, however fitfully and divided, to move to an expansion of international law, maybe to an expansion that would never have repeated the devastating, massive death, injury, and disease caused by the UN and US-backed sanctions during the 90s, when anywhere from 500,000 to a million innocent Iraqis died, in part because of the embargo under dual use of critical medicines and chlorine for purifying water, and in part because in 1991 there was a deliberate bombing of the infrastructure that destroyed the purification systems of drinking water, leading to all kinds of diseases, including cholera and typhoid, to which small children are most vulnerable. Having proceeded against Iraq, the five reasons given by President Bush were the following. One, weapons of mass destruction. You know, it's interesting the use of that term. It's as if a B-2 bomber is not a weapons of mass destruction. It's as if the massive military might that we can deploy with the latest massively devastating technologies are not weapons of mass destruction. What is then the definition of a weapon of mass destruction? It's a weapon that's used in an unfair way. Unfair way. Like chemical and biological warfare or nuclear weapons. Unfair way. This is playing with words. All weapons that kill human beings and destroy environments are weapons of mass destruction.
Former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader addressing the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee conference this weekend. We'll be back with his speech in a minute.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know.
Nina Simone here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we return to former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader.
As you all know, Saddam was our boy. We gave him a list of communist sympathizers. After he took power in 79, he wiped them out. Score one for his U.S. influential allies. Then we wanted him to take care of the burgeoning Iranian revolution, which was leaning left, leaning to the West. And, of course, we gave him intelligence backing. We gave him weapons. We gave him credits. We gave him money. We gave him cover. We even sold him the materials for anthrax and VX and sarin. And so when somebody says that he never had weapons of mass destruction, that's completely false. We have the receipts. After the 91 war, a lot of those weapons were destroyed. The inspectors did a good job. And now they can't find them. It was only a few weeks ago that President Bush, before the war started, said on his Saturday morning radio show that he had just learned through intelligence sources, think of the misuse of that word, intelligence sources, that Saddam had just given his field commanders authority to use the weapons of mass destruction. Somehow they had trouble getting down there because they weren't used. And now they haven't found them after weeks. But we're assured by top officials that they will be found. That sort of is an unsettling degree of non-empirical certainty. We were never told by our government that, given the massive remote technological weaponry that we have, that those chemical and biological materials don't have much strategic value, and they often blow back on their perpetrators. It's one reason why they're not used. It happened in World War I between the Kaiser's forces and the Allied forces. Brutal as it was, it didn't give one side any advantage. But they proceeded, and now the sands of Iraq are turning into quicksand. And if there is rain, we would call it a quagmire, as we called it in Vietnam. Now, what's the second act, other than trying to move to control 110 billion barrels of oil, other than to make the Bush regime's oil friends very happy? What are the people in Iraq? What is to become of them? And the children? And the disease, and the malnutrition, and the environmental devastation, and the looting, and the scoring of points, and all the rest of it, as an occupying army has to become larger and larger in order to cope with the resistance. And what is to become of our budgets? When half of the federal government's discretionary budget is now devoted to military expenditures, set aside Social Security, half of the federal government's budget goes to military, and we have no major enemy in the world, although we're looking for one. The conventional Pentagon budget is $400 billion. And rising, and there are other departments, such as Department of Energy and the nuclear weapons area, but it adds up. Most of the budget was built because of the Soviet Union's risk. There's no more Soviet Union. It was partially amassed because of Communist China. Communist China is rapidly converting criminal communism into criminal capitalism. They're not interested in threatening us. They want to sell to us. So why the $400 billion plus? Why the diversion from school kids and millions of Americans who don't have health insurance and people who want their clinics and schools and public transit built and repaired? Why no money for the inner cities? Why no money for our crumbling public works? Why no money for libraries, for clinics? Why no money for the necessities of the American people? There are tremendous cost to this diversion. And it's moving into a cycle of violence that's going to be a Moloch devouring even more of our government. It's time to say to the munitions corporations like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Boeing and General Dynamics and Grumman, have you no sense of self-restraint? Have you no decency? When are you going to stop defiling the flag which you wrap around yourself as you descend with your bags of money to the U.S. Congress to get more of the taxpayers' dollars from the needs of the American people? The American flag has been defiled, and the defilers are those who put the people who believe in what that flag really stands for on the defensive. That's quite a propaganda victory. The American flag was never meant to be a gag in the mouths of the American people. It was never meant to be a bandana for belligerent and lawless activity that brings so many innocent people to death, injury, and disease. It was never meant to be a fig leaf to hide the shame of the chicken hawks who were belligerently for the Vietnam War, but who pushed for more war as they swarmed around and in the White House, including George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl and John Ashcroft. Belligerent chicken hawk draft dodgers, including Rush Limbaugh, I might add. He has not hastened to inform you. He has not hastened to inform you that he got out of the draft because he felt he had a pimple on his rear. Let me indicate the obvious. Here's what the American flag stands for. There's no better description of what the American flag stands for than the last few words of our Pledge of Allegiance to that flag, which we'll all remember to be, quote, with liberty and justice for all. That's what that flag stands for.
You're listening to former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader, a major address he gave this weekend in Washington, D.C.
Of the five reasons for invading Iraq, the tie with Al-Qaeda, false. CIA, FBI were telling the White House that repeatedly, that Saddam is a threat to us. Saddam was a threat, and more than that, to the Iraqi people. But obviously the way he behaved after the planes attacked Iraq indicated that he wasn't even a threat to his own palaces, much less to anybody in his neighbors. And if he was ever a threat in the last 10 years to his neighbors, rest assured, if he ever had the capability and the intent of being a threat, any one of his three hostile neighbors, more powerful than he, would have moved in and destroyed his regime. We start with the weakest, Iran, then Turkey, and then the fifth strongest military power in the world, the Israeli military. Do you think they would have observed diplomatic niceties if Saddam Hussein was a threat to them? The Iraq war was based on a huge tissue of false pretenses, prevarication, and deception of the American people. Unforgivable. The only valid reason left was to overthrow a brutal tyrant who was entrenched and supported by us until 1991 to liberate the Iraqi people. That's the only plausible reason. It's not like we've been doing this around the world. I'm sure the people in Zaire would have loved to be liberated from Joseph Mobutu, who we entrenched as a tyrant, destroying hundreds of thousands of their people for 32 years. But we do have a responsibility to the people of Iraq because of what we did to them and who we supported, who ruled them. So let's see whether the aftermath of the overthrow of Saddam will reflect that touching concern increasingly focused on by President Bush and Vice President Cheney. That touching concern that now emerges as the main reason, we should all remember, for this overthrow. Afghanistan now is 99% under the control of the warlords, plundering, pillaging, bribing, fighting one another. What's the advantage from the overthrow of the Taliban from the viewpoint of the people of Afghanistan? We know what it is from the viewpoint of U.S. policy. In short, we're willing to go in, we're willing to topple, we're not willing to commit, we're not willing to stay, we're not willing to spend the necessary money, we're not willing to even restore some of the status quo ante before the Taliban and the prior regime went into power. Some of you who have been in Afghanistan know that that was a very, very active society with universities and art and culture and some reasonable efforts succeeding in feeding themselves. And they were getting better until they were caught in the vice between the U.S. and the USSR. Turning to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, what more can be said other than what you already have said for years and spoken to many groups? What more can be said than what Ed Said and Jim Abresk and others have said for many, many years? But I think there's a certain approach that needs to be punctuated, and that is the following. Criticism of Israeli actions in Palestinian areas is often chilled by the phrase anti-Semitism. When that word was used during and after World War II, it had a gravity following the Jewish Holocaust. It not only had a gravity, it elicited sympathy, support, grief. The increasingly cavalier use of the term anti-Semitism, increasingly focused on criticism of the present government of Israel, cheapens that term, turns it into a censorious device, turns it into the very suppression of dissent, which in any democratic society is most often the mother of future assent. It stifles people in our government, in our business world, at our universities. And it becomes not just what it was, grief, awe, sympathy. It's increasingly becoming an object through its reckless use of subdued derision. It's also broadly used where it shouldn't be used. Arabs are Semites. Jews who came from the Middle East are Semites. It's time to call the vicious discrimination when it occurs against Arab Americans the other anti-Semitism. As Jim Zoghbi pointed out years ago in an article, it's time to use it with prudence, not as a censorious device, but it's time to use it in a way that will send a message to those who recklessly use it to stifle dissent, to stifle the recognition of the facts, to stifle the criticism of the Israeli present-day military government. In almost the exact words that Israelis use in Israel, where there is far more freedom to criticize their government than there is in this country to criticize our government for not properly criticizing their government.
You're listening to Ralph Nader. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. This is Democracy Now!
You only have to read the writings of Peace Now, of Rabbis for Justice, of the human rights group B'Tselem, which has documented atrocities against the Palestinians in a highly specific and authentic manner. All honor to them. They document atrocities on all sides. But they're taking a lot of heat for documenting the far greater civilian casualties and children casualties on the Palestinian side. This very idea of debating equivalence of violence is anathema. Nonviolence should always be the top priority in resolving disputes. Once one or both sides devolves into violence, all their violence can be rationalized. All their violence. We rationalized Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 200,000 dead civilians. They were deliberately targeted to terrorize the population and destabilize the emperor and the military regime. I've seen rationalizations of violence by people who think they have justice on their side go to such extremes as to question the stability of the minds that tried to explain it away. When Rachel Curry was killed by that bulldozer, there were some people who were saying it was her fault. She asked for it. She shouldn't have been there. That's how far people will go once they use that as the overwhelming instrument of policy. Now, we have heard Secretary Colin Powell and others say there's no military solution to this conflict. Well, some people over there haven't heard that. And the people who manufacture cluster bombs and helicopter gunships and napalm and F-16s that are sent over there, they haven't heard that either. Whenever there's a conflict where there's huge imbalance of power between one side and the other, and do you know any conflict where there is a greater imbalance of military power between Israel and the Palestinians, between prehistoric stones with a few rifles and tanks and jets and artillery and helicopter gunships and all kinds of other super modern techniques of warfare? The question arises, can there ever be a peaceful solution, whether with a binational state, as Ed Said proposed years ago, or as a viable, as the saying goes, Palestinian state, capital East Jerusalem, ending the colonies, controlling the water, That's part of a viable Palestinian state. We wouldn't allow Canada to control, move in and control the headwaters of the Mississippi, would we? A viable Palestinian state involves all these and more that you've discussed. Now, who agrees with that? It's a severe criticism of our policy that our government has never allied itself with the very, very sizable peace movement inside Israel. It has done everything to marginalize it. It will support any regime that goes into power, regardless of whether it advocates peace or modus vivendi or status quo or takeover or burgeoning colonies or expulsion. The peace movement in Israel has filled Tel Aviv Square with 100,000 people demonstrating. That's like 5 million here. It is composed of members of the Knesset, former ministers of justice, distinguished artists, authors, scholars, workers, farmers. Before the most recent flashpoints in the last year or two, back and forth, a majority of the Israelis wanted essentially what is now being considered the fundamentals of a settlement. Except perhaps they would oppose the right of return because they don't understand that most people, Palestinians, once they got a great free Palestinian state, are not exactly going to want to return. Although some older Palestinians will. And that principle has to be fleshed out with some quantitative significance so it isn't inflated into a major propaganda excuse for sitting down and arriving at a settlement. I don't think we can exaggerate the importance of the Israeli peace movement as an authentically legitimizing force for freedom of speech on this issue in Congress, in our government, and in our civic arenas. And there's very little of that now. A high official of the Clinton administration walked up to me at some meeting. I'd never met him before. And out of the blue, he said the following, quote, "If you're a goy, you can't get an op-ed in the major newspapers criticizing Israel." I said, "You don't even know. What are you saying?" He said, "You only can criticize Israel if you're Jewish." Now, I mean, he just came up out of the blue. Obviously, he had it on his mind. Anybody he met down the stairs, he'd say the same thing. He'd have a number of op-eds rejected. This is a man of some substance and experience. Now, I want to take your patience just for a few minutes, and I want to read you what I mean when I say that there should be a demand in our government, if they are really interested in a just peace, to begin contacting, supporting, and giving a stage to the Israeli peace movement and its allies in this country, such as led by Rabbi Michael Lerner and Peace Now and others. And I think the consequences of this will be to recognize that until that balance of power is restored by the United States in that equation over there, no matter what words you hear from administration officials, and they're getting a bit hackneyed, they're going nowhere. They're going nowhere because one side has too much military power and doesn't have an even greater military and political power restraining it. Israeli combat veterans over a year ago started the Refusnik movement. They said they would never serve with the Israeli army, and they're called up every year. They'll never serve in the West Bank and Gaza. And in a statement in the leading Israeli newspaper announcing this courageous action, they said the following: "We will no longer fight beyond the green line for the purpose of occupying, deporting, destroying, blockading, killing, starving, and humiliating an entire people," end quote. They were referring to the Palestinian people. They now number over 1,000. They're not getting much publicity now. But you can imagine the courage it took. You can imagine the pressure they're under. You can imagine how many of them have already gone to jail. This is their statement. They said they would defend Israel proper, as they have in the past. They will not be an instrument of oppression of the Palestinian people. The website is seruv.org, www.seruv.org. Now I want to just go very briefly in making this point. Israeli Premier at the time, Ehud Barak, quoted in Haaretz, 3 June 1998, quote, "If I were a Palestinian, I'd also join a terror group," end quote. I'm sure he's not justifying that kind of activity against his people. What he meant was that he would be fighting for the liberation of his people if he was on the other side. David Ben-Gurion, first Israeli prime minister, quoted by Nahum Goldman in the book The Israeli Paradox, quote, "If I were an Arab leader, I would never sign an agreement with Israel. It is normal. We've taken their country. It is true God promised it to us, but how could that interest them? Our God is not theirs. There has been anti-Semitism, the Nazis, Hitler, Auschwitz, but was that their fault? They see but one thing. We have come and we have stolen their country. Why would they accept that?" End quote. David Ben-Gurion. Ishai Rosen-Zvi, reservist who refused to serve in the occupied areas. April 4th, 2002. Quote, "We are at war again. What is this war intended for? Preventing terrorism? This isn't even an unfunny joke. It is clear and embarrassing to repeat that these operations are the ultimate laboratories for the creation of terrorism. The occupation of towns and villages, the breaking and entry and vandalizing of homes, the cutting off, the humiliation, the suppression, the killing are the fastest and most effective factories of terrorism. The facts are simple and cry to high heaven. Several years back, less than 20% of the Palestinians supported suicide bombings. Today, it is hard to find someone among them who will denounce this phenomenon. The current policy of the IDF in the occupied territories is a great hothouse for terror. Nobody believes that more occupation, more killing, destroying, and humiliation will help to decimate it. Don't talk about peace. Netanyahu talks about peace also. Talk about the end of the occupation." End quote. Israeli reservist, combat veteran. Shulamit Aloni, many of you know. Quote, former cabinet member in the Israeli government. Quote, "We're going backwards. What's so difficult to understand? The Jews were once victims. Now we are brainwashed to believe we will always be victims, and victims can do no wrong. Suddenly we become strong and greedy and pretend we can justify everything. We are told all the time the Palestinians want to throw us into the sea. We have 6 million people and the strongest army in the region, and yet we speak of them as if they were two equal powers. It's just manipulating people's fears." End quote. Bear with me. In a book Ben-Gurion published in 1931 titled We and Our Neighbors, he explained that Palestinian Arabs had the same rights as Jews to exist in Palestine. He said, quote, "The Arab community in Palestine is an organic, inseparable part of the landscape. It is embedded in the country. The Arabs work the land and will remain," end quote. Moshe Dayan, one of the most candid generals in Israeli history, especially when he's talking to Israelis. And he said the following, 1969, quoted in Haaretz, April 4th, quote, "Jewish villages were built in the place of Arab villages. You do not even know the names of these Arab villages. And I do not blame you, because geography books no longer exist. Not only do the books not exist, the Arab villages are not there either. Nahal arose in the place of Mahlu, Kibbutz Gva in the place of Jipta, Kibbutz Sand in the place of Hunayfis, and Kfar Yehoshua in the place of Tal al-Shuman. There is not one single place built in this country that did not have a former Arab population," end quote, Moshe Dayan. And you can go right down to the present day with brave and persistent statements by members of the peace movement in Israel, including religious Zionists, 170 of them, who recently demanded an end to the occupation and to the settlement policy. What to make of all this? I think in conclusion, what we have to make is this. We must never flag from our denunciation of violence in all its forms on all sides. We must never flag from the addition to that denunciation with demanding that our government perform in a just manner in resolving that conflict. The history of the world shows that there is no suppression of people's adherence to their homelands other than expulsion or genocide. North America was an example of both. And so the government has to confront, our government has to confront this verity. Are they going to continue to allow the resolution of that crisis to be subordinated to the priority of short-term political advantage? Or are they going to stand tall before history, reverse a terrible course of injustice which our government had a hand in from the beginning, and establish the conditions and supervise the resolution so that two states can live in peace together and compete economically, culturally, athletically, in all other ways as befits human beings for whom justice is the great work on earth? Thank you very much.
Former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader speaking this weekend at the conference of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Washington, D.C. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Ribal and Vilka Tsouris. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
All things and what they used to be.